irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm here to help you make peace with food and lose weight, all without dieting. And today I am very pleased and excited to have a special guest here in the studio. Dr. Adrian Udeem is here. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Udeem. After nearly a decade of serving as the medical director of the Center of Weight Loss at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, Dr. Udeem has brought her passion and expertise to open the Center for Weight Loss and Nutrition at the preeminent Lasky Clinic in Beverly Hills. In addition to her private practice, Dr. Udeem writes extensively, including daily health tips via social media, and she's developed a health app, FitNote, to assist you to achieve your health and wellness goals, and a line of vitamins, minerals, and supplements available on her website. She specializes in medical weight loss, medical nutritional therapy, and the nutritional and metabolic support of bariatric surgery patients. And that's not all. She is board certified with, trust me, a lot of letters after her name. So many, it would take me half the show to read them. Trust me, lots of letters. She is currently Associate Professor of Medicine at UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Medicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. She has lectured extensively at the local and national level. She's authored numerous articles and chapters. And she is sought after by local and national news and television programs. She's been on Dr. Oz, The Doctors, NPR, and other media outlets. And I am so glad to have her here with us today. So welcome, Dr. Udeem.
Thank you, Dr. Nina. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the kind introduction.
Oh, well, nothing kind about it. You absolutely earned it. So, you know, just today, just this morning, because I saw someone before I came, and she was saying how she had done something she'd never done before. She had allowed herself to have an English muffin for breakfast. And this was just incredible to her, because she's like, I know I'm not supposed to have carbs, but I had carbs. And you know what? I'm still alive. So there's so much misinformation or conflicting information about carbs. Let's just start there. Are carbs bad?
Yeah, that's a good point and a good question. You're right. We have vilified carbohydrates in our society, and it kind of makes me think of the whole fat issue. You know, 10 years ago, we hated fats, and after much research, we now are aware that fats are actually good for us. Good fats help our cholesterol profile. They help protect the heart, the brain. And I think we're going to have the same kind of aha moment about carbohydrates after vilifying them for so long. I think the first point is that not all carbohydrates are the same. Fruits are carbohydrates. Vegetables are carbohydrates. Legumes, beans are all carbohydrates. It's true that the processed stuff is not great. You know, I call them sometimes foods just because they're not providing you any nutrients. But that having been said, there's no reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater and eliminate all carbohydrates altogether. In fact, it's interesting. They've done many medical studies on this, and they've shown that as little as half a cup of beans, for example, a day can result in longer life.
Wow.
Actually enhances longevity. So there's no reason why we should be eliminating all of these carbohydrates from our diet.
So I like that you say sometimes foods, not never foods, because in my experience, you know, from a psychological point of view, the anticipation of deprivation, I can never have cake again until I lose 20 pounds, always leads to eventually binging on that thing that you think you're not supposed to have. So what about those not so healthy carbs? What is your position on those?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, they are sometimes foods. I think, you know, eating with intention is important. And what I try and relay to my patients is make it matter. So if you're eating, either eat for the nourishment. If you know you're eating for the pleasure of it, then do it knowingly and move on.
And you make a really good point, because in this age of clean eating, I'm sure you hear that all the time, I ate really clean.
Yep.
Like, it makes me want to say, well, what's dirty eating then? You know what? there's this idea that you're not supposed to enjoy food, and we are supposed to enjoy food. If we weren't, we'd all be eating astronaut pellets or something. So, and that is a valid reason to have a piece of cake, just for the enjoyment of it. It doesn't mean you have two pieces of cake or cake every day, but it's okay to have a treat every once in a while as part of normal, healthy eating.
Absolutely. And this concept of balance, you know, neither here nor there, but something in between, is so important and so hard for us to grasp. Eating can be family. Eating can be nurturing. Eating can be love, you know, or food, rather, can mean all of those things. And sometimes food is also fuel. And so having a balance between those two concepts, I think, results in kind of a healthy mindset about food and eating.
Yeah, and it's so refreshing to hear you say that, because so often people believe that food should only be fuel, and that if it's anything else to them, they become deeply ashamed. Oh, I can't believe I failed to in my food as fuel mentality, and I ate that because I wanted it. And then of course that shame often leads to eating more to comfort themselves, and it's a vicious, horrible cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. That sentiment of sabotage, that when you can't just accept where you're at with what you're eating, and how that results in badgering yourself and ultimately sabotaging your overall health goals, is absolutely valid.
So since we're talking about kind of perspectives on what you should eat or what you shouldn't eat, I am really interested to know what you think of this new ketogenic diet and paleo and all of that, because I am not a dietitian. I'm not a medical doctor, but the idea of putting 5 tablespoons of oil in your coffee every morning as a means of being healthy just doesn't seem right to me. Can you shed some light on that?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know that a lot of people know this, but the keto diet was initially created to treat epilepsy. So for children or pediatric population that had unretractable seizures, this diet somehow, and we don't really know the mechanism, allowed for them to go into remission of seizures. So the intention was kind of something very different than what it turned out. I think the benefits of keto in weight loss really is because you're eliminating this big category, you know, carbohydrates, and among them the processed, refined ones that aren't so good for us. I think that's really what's driving the weight loss and not so much the ketosis. We don't have a lot of medical evidence around this, and if in fact ketosis is enhancing weight loss. I personally don't think so, but we don't really know. It is pretty extreme though, and I don't know that it's necessary. There are some long-term, you know, side effects of a ketogenic diet. It can result in electrolyte abnormalities. It can result in low bone density, kidney stones. So these are things that people need to be wary of. At the end of the day, I like to support people in whatever path they think serves their body in reaching that objective. But to give this sweeping advice that keto is right for everybody, I agree, is not the right message.
Or that any diet or way of eating is right for everybody, because we're all such individuals and respond differently. Maybe people lose weight on keto because they're eating so much fat, and fat inhibits appetite.
That is part of the mechanism, that fat is satiating, and so it is reducing your appetite. One of the other possible mechanisms is that the ketones actually are suppressing appetite. Mm. I personally think that the high protein in the diet is satiating. There are a lot of studies that show protein does suppress hunger hormones throughout the day. But again, these are speculative. We don't really have data. And to that end, we have to understand that there could be harms that are unknown to us. So use caution.
Right, right. It's so interesting. If you have a question for Dr. Udim, or you'd like to share any of your experience, or you have a question for me, give us a call. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. Okay, so we talked about keto. What about the other very popular diet that's happening nowadays, paleo?
Yeah, I think these are all kind of spin-offs of the same no-carb mentality. You know, I think for some people it has been successful in enabling them to lose weight, eliminate bad foods, excuse me, from the diet. But again, for me, when there are studies demonstrating health benefits of just half a cup of beans, I wouldn't want to recommend a lifetime without them. There are benefits to having a balanced diet. And so my advice would be, if you want to use these modalities short term to help jumpstart you or kickstart you or get you on the right track, I think all of that is fine. But ultimately, a lifelong healthy eating plan needs to be a balanced food plan.
As in all things, balance. Balance is what is necessary in all areas of life, including what we eat. So just to take a little bit of a detour. What about alcohol? I also hear mixed things about alcohol. Like, oh, red wine is good for your heart. Drink red wine. Oh, no, don't drink alcohol. It causes cancer. What's the truth about alcohol? And are two questions. And are all alcohols the same?
Good question. So you're right. Historically, and for years, we've been talking about the health benefits of alcohol and specifically red wine as part of a Mediterranean diet, how it is heart healthy, protective of the heart, raises HDL. All of these things are true. We have to keep in mind, though, that those countries are having a modest consumption of wine, meaning like 4 ounces, which is typically not what we consume in the United States. The flip side to that is also true, that alcohol is associated with numerous cancers. Most well studied is the link between alcohol and breast cancer, and that is a dose dependent response, meaning the more number of drinks you have in a day or in a night, the higher your risk of breast cancer. Also, other reproductive cancers, stomach cancer. I mean, there is a handful that are linked to alcohol. I think that in moderation, consumption of alcohol is fine. I think chronic and persistent consumption can have adverse health benefits or effects, rather.
So define moderation.
This is also a moving target. So like I said, in Mediterranean countries, or when you look at the Mediterranean food pyramid, they usually suggest 4 ounces. We used to say in our kind of diagnostic criteria, 1 drink a day for women and 2 drinks a day for men. But again, that is a moving target because we know that even 1 drink nightly can be associated with some risk. So I think alcohol falls into the category of, sometimes foods. I will also say that alcohol has become something that we use pretty avidly in our culture now. It has become a big part of our socialization. And so it's something to be looked at.
Yeah, and I know, and is drinking red wine the same as drinking, say, a vodka martini? I mean, it can't be the same.
Well, we know that the phytosterols or the antioxidants as part of red or even white wine have some heart-healthy benefits. From a caloric perspective, the hard alcohols tend to be less. And from a heart perspective, we know that, for example, drinking beer even may be just as beneficial in small quantities as drinking wine. But I think when you were talking about things like cancer, it hasn't been as clearly fleshed out yet.
So again, I guess the theme of the day is balance.
Absolutely. You know, that's balance. What we will keep coming back to.
Yes, yes. Always, always so important. Okay, so let's talk about that as it applies to exercise. Because one thing that I hear constantly is, I know I should go to the gym, but I just can't go and work out for an hour and a half. And like, what makes you think you have to go to the gym and work out for an hour and a half? And if you don't work out for an hour and a half, somehow you're lazy. There's this idea that there's this all or nothing, no balance, kind of approach to exercise too. But you say that you can actually exercise for 6 minutes and have life-saving benefits.
Yeah, this is so interesting. So there was a study that came out that looked at sedentary behaviors versus active behaviors. And in the first part of the study, they found that those people who sat for 8 or more hours a day, so a typical 8-hour desk job, had a shorter lifespan than people who didn't sit 8 or more hours per day. But the flip side to that was that people who exercise as little as 6 to 7 minutes a day had a longer lifespan or had greater longevity than those who did not. So let's start with 7 minutes. To your point, it doesn't need to be the gym for an hour or an hour and a half. I tell my patients, if it's a hurdle for you to think about daily exercise, let's start with 7 minutes, 10 minutes in the morning, and make it a ritual. We brush our teeth every morning. Let's get up and be active every morning for just 10 minutes. And then eventually, for most people, they get the bug. You know, they are active. They feel the endorphins that result from moving your body, and they increase that duration of time. But I do feel like this daily activity needs to somehow be engineered into our lives, because the health benefits of physical activity are so tremendous. If I had a pill that gave you all the health benefits of 30 minutes of walking a day, I'd retire. So, you know, 30 minutes of walking has been linked to reduced incidence of type 2 diabetes, reduced heart disease, better cognitive function, reduced Alzheimer's disease, reduced cancer events. I mean, the list of health benefits with daily activity are endless, and we just need to get started. So let's start with 7 minutes a day.
Yeah, if you have a dog, it is very easy to walk your dog for 7 minutes. You know, just go out there and do it.
That's right, and it can be anything. It can be walking the dog. There are so many health apps now. There are YouTube videos. You can get a Bosu ball and put it at the foot of your bed. I mean, there's so many do-it-yourself ways of being active. It doesn't require an expensive gym membership, which, by the way, takes a lot of time. I mean, time is a valuable resource these days, and to drive to the gym, park, these things are usually barriers for us to be physically active, and they need not be.
Yeah, and the other barrier that I hear is, oh, I will be the fattest person at the gym and I can't do that, or people are going to look at me and I'm not going to fit in and I can't do that. But you know, to your point, the gym is not the only place where you can get some physical activity. I actually have an app called Swerkit. It's so fun.
I love the name.
It's Swerkit. And with Swerkit, it actually, you can choose what you're going to do. Like, you could do yoga, you could do cardio, you could do stretching, you could do whatever. Plyogenics?
Yeah.
Plyometrics. Plyometrics. Yes, I knew that wasn't quite right. And then it shows a little person who does it along with you, so you're not even alone as you're doing your little workout.
I love that.
It's super cute.
I love that. That is super cute. But yeah, let's just move. Let's just move, and your body and your mind will be grateful.
Yeah, there's a regular caller. I don't know. Are you listening, Nick? If you're listening, call in. But he once called in and said that he knew that, you know, he should walk, but he just couldn't make himself walk, and he felt so lazy, and he was just beating himself up for being so lazy. And I said, Nick, do you like walking? No, I hate walking. I said, well, why are you trying to make yourself do something you don't like? What do you like? And he said, well, I like tennis. Awesome. Go play tennis. And he did. And that when it's something you love to do, that's easy. That doesn't feel like exercise.
Yeah, I think the word exercise has such a negative connotation for people because they envision being tortured on a treadmill. And you're right, it can take so many shapes and forms. I love to tell people just plug in your playlist, favorite playlist, and dance around the house for 20 minutes. That's a great workout.
Yeah, that's what my 10-year-old does, like half the afternoon. She's plugged in, she's dancing around, she's having a great time. She doesn't realize she's getting exercise. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
And fun. And it takes you back to when you're like, you know, 14 and doing that.
14 and free and not thinking about what other people are thinking of you at the gym, right?
That's right. That's right. And the remedy to wondering about what people are thinking about you is to think about what you think of them, you know? Not from a judgmental perspective, but getting instead of eyes on you, what do you see? What do you like? What do you want to do? Think about your eyes on the world instead of on you.
Yeah, or your eyes on yourself. You know, bring it inward and do what's right for you.
Yeah, great point. Okay, I'm almost afraid to ask you this, but you're here, so I have to ask you. I am a huge coffee advocate. It's like 30% of my bloodstream at any given time. I cannot imagine life without coffee. I'm like I said, I'm afraid to ask you, is coffee good for you, bad for you?
Don't be afraid. As I sit here with my own cup right next to me, you know, there's actually great data for drinking coffee. Believe it or not, coffee is the biggest source of antioxidants in our diet. There's over 1,000 antioxidants in a cup of coffee. And coffee actually has health benefits. So it has been associated with reduced mortality, reduced cancer risk, as well as reduced cardiovascular disease mortality. So there are benefits to your body. But again, it's about balance. I'm not sure that 30% of the bloodstream, Dr. Nina, is what I would recommend.
I exaggerate slightly. Okay, I have 3 cups a day.
But something between 1 to 2 cups and 30% is probably the right place to be. And there are health benefits. Now, that having been said, there have been a lot of reports of caffeine ingestion in the news, especially with young athletes, caffeinated drinks. And so, you know, not everybody is the same. If you have some underlying cardiovascular rhythmic disorder, it can be harmful if used in excess. But when we're taking the general population, 1 to 2 cups of coffee a day is actually healthy.
And 3 isn't terrible, right? From what you're telling me, it's kind of a health drink. So,
ish.
I'm just going to hear what I want to hear. No, thank you. Thank you for enlightening. And yes, she is drinking, but it's like a tall Starbucks. It's not like a venti or something. She's the picture of moderation. She practices what she preaches. Okay, so let's get back to diet. And I want to invite anyone out there to join us. Again, the number's 818-602-4929. Join the conversation. We have Dr. Adrienne Udeem here. She can answer any of your questions about health, diet, weight loss. So if there's something you're burning to know, now is the time to give her a call. 818-602-4929. Okay, so getting back to diet. What about protein? Now, you kind of touched on that when we were talking about paleo, but tell us the importance of getting enough protein in our diets.
Yeah, protein is super important. The amount really depends on your state of health, your age, and what exactly you're trying to accomplish. So, for example, people who are trying to lose weight, they actually require 1 to 2 times the RDA, or the recommended amount of protein in the diet, in order to not lose muscle mass. So when we lose weight, we can lose fat, which is preferred, or we can lose muscle. And some of that loss of muscle may be physiologic, so we may not be able to prevent it or mitigate it 100%, especially in individuals who are losing you know, large amounts of weight. So what comes to mind is a patient after bariatric surgery, maybe losing up to 100 pounds. They will lose some muscle. That having been said, if you have adequate protein, up to 2 times the RDA, so that's roughly 80 to 100 grams of protein, and we can talk about what foods give you that amount. That coupled with physical activity will prevent or reduce the amount of muscle loss. That's important for 2 reasons. One, if you're losing weight and losing muscle, then your percent body fat is actually going to go up. So you may look smaller and lighter on the scale, but from a body composition perspective, your percent body fat goes up. The second point is that your metabolism can be affected more drastically when you lose muscle mass. So people do drop their metabolism if they lose weight in any way, shape, or form. And that's just because you have less body, you require less energy to move that body or to keep that body alive. But muscle is going to burn more calories. So if you lose more muscle, you're at risk for dropping your metabolism further, which just makes it so much harder to maintain.
And easier to regain weight after you're off the diet, because now your body's more efficient and your metabolism is slower and you require fewer calories. It's a horrible cycle.
That's exactly right. So a lot of times people question, well, how can I get that amount of protein? And there's misconceptions about the foods that give you protein. So obviously animal protein is the, you know, the most robust. 3 ounces of meat, which I'm not recommending regular meat consumption, but just by way of example, is about 30 grams. Chicken, 21 grams, or rather 27 grams. Fish, 21 grams. A tablespoon of peanut butter, 2 grams. A piece of cheese, 1 gram.
Oh.
So sometimes we consume these other foods in the name of protein, but it's not really giving us much. So it's just important to be aware. Know what you're eating.
So if you're a vegetarian and you want to lose weight and you need more protein, what is the most efficient way to get your protein?
Yeah, so beans and legumes are a good source of protein in that scenario. If you're a vegetarian and not vegan, then you can incorporate eggs, which give you about 7 grams of protein. The egg whites, which I'm not advocating to eliminate the yolk, but the egg whites give you 4 grams of protein.
Oh, let me interject. Because I always hear, oh, the yolk is bad. Get rid, you know, my husband always orders omelets without the yolks as if they're the devil that he will not allow into his pristine body. But, you know, like, I'm like, why aren't you having the yolks? And he's like, well, they're bad. They're full of cholesterol and they're just bad. Please tell me so I can tell him why he should eat the yolks.
Yes, you know, yolks, egg yolks got such a bad rap, and it's just another example of this media or public perception train that just runs awry. Mm-hmm. It's true. Egg yolk has or contains cholesterol. If you are at risk for heart disease or have heart disease or have high cholesterol, you probably shouldn't be consuming egg yolks on a daily basis. Does that mean you have to eliminate it completely? Absolutely not. Does that mean that if you are an individual that is not at risk, that you have to eliminate it? Absolutely not. There are so many benefits to the egg yolk. I'll give you one example. So choline is a mineral that's found in our diet that's very important in cognitive development, particularly for a growing fetus. And there have been surveys that have shown that women of childbearing age are choline deficient. Well, egg yolk is a very good source of choline. So in a way, eliminating this from our diet, especially in healthy young women, is actually potentially having an adverse effect on that baby. So there's a reason. There's a reason why we have these foods, and it should be incorporated unless there's a compelling reason otherwise.
Right. Well, because I know he doesn't like those egg yolks all that much. They do not look very tasty. So I'm going to relieve him of his guilt and his ideas and say, you need to get your choline on. So have a real omelet, will you please?
You know, another thing about this egg white omelet is funny you should mention it, because egg white omelets have become this vision of health, right? So the little poor little egg white is about 30 calories. And I know we don't like to talk about calories, but it's just an interesting point. 30 calories per egg white. So you could have 10 egg whites for 300 calories. I mean, so lean, so healthy. But that one ladle of butter that they pour on the grill to cook your egg white, that probably is equivalent to about 7 to 10 egg whites. So you've got this poor little 30-calorie egg white that's immersed in a sea of butter.
Fat.
So maybe go poached.
Yeah. Hard-boiled, soft-boiled. Yeah, that's an excellent point. People feel very virtuous about ordering what they think is clean and then don't think about the other implications of how it's being cooked.
And eating out is a tough one, you know, because we do it for pleasure. We do it for socialization. We eat out for convenience. But daily, eating out daily is a health risk. There's a JAMA article that came out a few years ago that looked at the average restaurant meal, and this was not just fast food, but an average restaurant meal was on the order of 2,000 calories. That's like your daily... I'm sorry, not 2,000. I misspoke. 1,200 calories. But that's close to your daily requirement.
Right.
Over 30% fat. Over 2 grams of sodium, which is over your daily allotment. So what I like to advise people is, you know, if you're going out for socialization once in a while, that's great. Do it and enjoy it. But let's not eat out for convenience, because it's really not so hard to prepare and to pre-plan. There's a lot of easy, quick ways that you can pack and go. We don't expect everybody in this day and age to be Martha Stewart and with an apron, right? Making this gourmet 8-course meal. But there are quick ways that you can prepare a meal so that you're not eating out every single lunch. And even that salad is a problem when you're eating out.
Yes, let's talk about salad, because people, you know, feel like they've got to eat a salad. You know, you go out and I sometimes listen to people when they're women together, when they're ordering, and it's like, oh, I really want a burger, but I'm going to have a salad, or I really want this, but I'm going to have a salad. It's just such a constant refrain. So what do you want people to know about this? I should really have a salad.
So I do think that I always tell my patients half your plate needs to be green. And by green, I just mean fresh something. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge believer that you need to consume fruits and vegetables or vegetables with every single meal. That includes breakfast. And if that means a salad to you, great. But prepare it on your own. I do weekly newsletters for my patients. And a few months ago, we did a newsletter where we compared the nutrient content of various salads from healthy local restaurants. And we compared it to the paleo burger at a local burger joint. And believe it or not, the vegan salad was the most calorie and fat dense. And the paleo burger was the least. So don't assume that just because it's a salad that it is necessarily the healthiest option. A cup of spinach is 5 calories and filled with vitamins and minerals. A cup of arugula is only 2 calories and has over 15 to 20 vitamins and minerals. So from a nutrient density perspective, so high in nutrients, right? But then a tablespoon of the dressing is about 80 to 90 calories, and that's just one tablespoon. Right. The nuts, the cheese, the whatever else quickly amplifies, you know, the density of what you're eating.
That is a great point, and that is just a shocking comparison that the paleo burger was healthier than the salad.
I mean, I was surprised. And so I don't want to say that the salads are not healthy, but you can tip the balance quickly if you're not careful of what you're putting in those salads.
Well, it's one thing to have a salad with vegetables and, you know, a little vinaigrette, and then it's another thing to have a salad with cheese and croutons and whatever people put on salads that's, you know, not the healthiest. And then suddenly you have this 1,000-calorie salad, and you think, oh, I just ate a salad for lunch, and you don't really realize what you're putting in your body.
Yeah, and I don't blame people. It's a easy mistake to make, especially because it's being promoted as a health meal. But the truth is that unless you prepare something on your own, you really don't know what you're getting. You know, salads aren't the only health myth. Another big one that used to be a huge pet peeve were the acai bowls. They're kind of, I think, falling from favor, though, don't you think? We're not talking acai bowls so much.
Not so much. You don't see them everywhere.
You don't see and hear about them all the time. But, you know, there was one place that sold acai bowls, a very well-known company. I'm not going to name drop. But there was 92 grams of sugar in one bowl. That's almost equivalent to 4 cans of Coca-Cola.
Wow.
Lots of sugar, and not just natural sugars coming from fruit, but coming from the granola, for example. Super high in sugar and not very nutrient dense. So people were consuming these acai bowls for health, but really they were getting, you know, 4 cans of sugar in place of that.
Yeah. Any more? These health myths that you are busting are so helpful because, you know, as you said, people don't know, and if they don't have access to the education and understanding, how would they know?
So yeah, I mean, I think another one, people who know me know I'm a big fan of protein shakes and smoothies. I think especially for breakfast, because people, we tend to run out the door. We're not hungry yet. We tend to run out the door and not having eaten anything. I think that's a good replacement. Or people run out the door, grab their coffee, and then they realize, oh, maybe I am hungry. And then they have that muffin that's, you know, out of convenience again, not right for planning, or out of good planning. So I do think protein shakes are great. But when you're getting them on the outside, a protein smoothie, you add a tablespoon of peanut butter, that's another 100 calories. You add a tablespoon of chia seeds, that's another 60 calories. You add a cup of soy milk, that can be up to 200 more calories. And so there may be health benefits to all these things, the good fats, the chia. I'm not making it all a calorie game, but just be aware that that drink that you're having could quickly become this 600-700 calorie drink. And if you're trying to maintain your weight, which, you know, most of America is, 67% of our population is either overweight or obese, and it is a struggle in this environment to keep a healthy weight. So if your intention is to try and achieve a healthy weight, know that that smoothie that is being boasted as such a great health food may not be the best route.
Yeah, even though I advocate that, you know, you can lose weight without counting calories, of course you still have to be cognizant and aware of kind of the range of calories that you're eating. And it's so interesting. I'm sorry, I'm picking on my husband again today, because he used to get these matcha green teas at some place where I will also not say where they are from. But they were like milkshakes. And he works out every day. He's super into health. Works out every day really strenuously, and then he's like, God, I don't know, I feel like my pants are tighter, I don't know, why am I gaining weight, I'm not eating anything more, like what's going on, I eat egg whites, why am I gaining weight? And I said, do you know what's in those grande matcha green teas of yours? And he's like, they're healthy. And I said, they're not healthy. And I looked it up or something, and it was something like 700 calories per cup.
It's impressive, right?
It was shocking.
And I know that neither you nor I are advocate for or believer of counting every calorie in your mouth, but a general awareness of what's in the foods that you eat is important, so that you just know.
Yeah.
And you make that decision mindfully.
So, exactly. Perfectly, perfectly said. Okay, now I have another question for you. So my pediatrician told me that the new recommendation is not to give kids vitamins. And so I have not been giving my daughter vitamins. She came home from school last week and she said, "Mom, you need to get me some vitamins. Like, I need vitamins." And apparently there was a whole discussion in her group of little 10-year-olds about having vitamins. So what's the truth about vitamins? There's so much conflicting information.
There is. And I think, again, that's because we try and lump all vitamins and minerals and supplements into one category and try and extrapolate that information to all people. And it just doesn't work that way. I agree that for a child with a healthy, balanced diet, there is no need for supplemental vitamins. And we don't know what the downside is. Perhaps a supplemental vitamin has excess of a certain nutrient that for a child is excessive. So I don't recommend it. I don't give my children vitamins. But there is data for specific ones. So vitamin D, for example, we are all chronically deficient in vitamin D, and the recommendations are for supplemental vitamin D. So again, the type of vitamin, mineral, nutrient supplement matters. Another example is that omega-3 fatty acids have been demonstrated to have health benefit, particularly in the area of cardiovascular health and cognitive health. Now, if you're having or consuming 2 to 3 servings of fish per day, perhaps you don't need that. But if you're not consuming that amount and you're at risk for heart disease, the studies show that a gram of omega-3 fatty acids is beneficial. So again, it's the problem, I think, is that we try and extrapolate this to all comers, and a lot of the data out there that has looked at vitamins and shown for it to not have a health benefit is because they don't isolate individual populations. My guidance towards my patients are not to supplement extensively and without cause or need, but to really use a tailored approach.
Oh, I have another question for you. Another hot supplement, turmeric.
Yeah, turmeric is great. So turmeric is used pretty extensively in Mediterranean cuisine and Indian and South Asian cuisine. There are a lot of health benefits to turmeric, namely anti-inflammatory properties. And I typically believe in consuming the whole food. So if you can learn to use turmeric in your cooking, or if you want to get the turmeric root and incorporate it in your health drink that you make on your own, for example, I think there's a benefit to that. Whether or not turmeric in a capsule is as beneficial, I'm not sure. There may not be any downside or harm in doing that. But I think if we're just looking at the category of turmeric consumption, there are lots of benefits.
But as with most things, getting the nutrients from the actual whole food is better than getting it from a capsule
tablet. Right. And so, I have different approaches with my patients depending on what their needs are. Ultimately, we transition to a healthy, balanced diet that incorporates everything, hopefully from food. But in the meantime, there are certain circumstances in which people are not having the right nutrients, or certain health conditions in which they're not absorbing the right nutrients. And so I think really a tailored approach is necessary.
Okay, now continuing with the subject of vitamins. Vitamins is it true they've been correlated to back pain or fatigue, or there's something to do with vitamins and fatigue or back pain?
I think fatigue is an easier one to tackle. So fatigue is one of these very general and common symptoms that can be linked to everything from a noisy neighbor or an infant child, right, to a thyroid condition, to something more severe. And so I think we have to approach that complaint with a rigorous mind and try and decipher whether there's something environmental going on, something organic or physiologic going on. But there aren't nutrient deficiencies that are linked to fatigue. Probably the most important ones that come to mind, iron and B12 are necessary for blood cell production. And in certain circumstances, excessive blood loss, heavy menses, a vegan or a vegetarian diet, you can be deficient in either of those minerals and vitamins in the case of B12. And so prolonged malnutrition of those vitamins can result in low blood counts, anemia, and fatigue. So again, there's a lot of different pathways, and we have to kind of be rigorous in how we look at it. But yes, vitamin and mineral levels can certainly result in fatigue.
And what I have found often is that people eat, when they're thirsty, they eat. When they're tired, they eat. They use food for the purpose that they really need to, you know, you need to drink water if you're thirsty. If you're tired, you need to take a nap, not eat a chocolate bar. And so,
yeah, it's kind of like the end all be all tool for all ills.
Yes.
It's interesting because our thirst cues do get confused with our hunger cues. And it is true that sometimes what's perceived as hunger is really just thirst in disguise. So keeping well hydrated, you know, is important, and not with coffee, for example, but true water as well. But keeping hydrated is important. And from the perspective of weight loss, those cues can get jumbled up. Fatigue is another important one. Actually, the connection between sleeplessness and food, weight, and health is a really significant one. We know that people who are chronically sleep deprived, night shift workers, for example, these individuals are at much greater risk for metabolic syndrome, for insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. As little as 2 nights of sleep deprivation results in insulin resistance. As well.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty profound. And that's not to say that it's not reversible, but let's look at the majority of us who are chronically sleep deprived. We are really putting ourselves at risk. The other thing that happens with sleep deprivation is that hunger hormones go up. And so they've shown that, you know, when you pulled an all-nighter, you know, in college, and then the next morning you have this craving for like hash browns or a donut, that's actually physiologic. So not only do hunger hormones go up, but the cravings for high sugar and high fat foods also goes up with sleep deprivation. So getting adequate sleep is important not only for mood, memory, cognition, optimal performance in the workplace, but it's also important for regulating blood sugars as well as regulating your weight.
So it's a pretty easy fix, you know, give it a try, get enough sleep and see, you know, what happens the next few days. Are you less hungry? Do you have fewer cravings? That is a very simple thing to achieve, and you're going to feel better no matter what.
Yeah, simple but hard at the same time, because we all feel like we're so pressed for time and we don't have the time to get that minimum of 7 hours of sleep a night. But if we really evaluate what we're doing at night, a lot of us are mindlessly scrolling through our phones as a distraction, which also, of course, is not great for the sleep-wake cycle. But really looking at how we're spending our time, there's probably improvements that we can all make, eliminating those things that are just not necessary or reducing the time we spend doing those things and putting it towards sleep, which I see sleep as a nutrient. It's really restoring your body.
That is a lovely way to put it. Sleep is a nutrient. Vitamin sleep. Vitamin S.
I like that. I may have to incorporate that in a quote somewhere.
Feel free. Take it. It's yours. Vitamin S. No, that this has just been so amazingly helpful, and there's so many insights and so much information, and this has been wonderful. Tell me, if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to get your newsletter, if they want to find out more about you, go all the things that you have to offer, how do they do that?
Well, there's several outlets. I'd love for you all to visit our website, dradrianudim.com. So it's dradrianudim.com. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletters there. We're also on social media, at Dr. Adrian Udim. So daily health tips on Instagram, motivational quotes, as well as recipes, etc.
She covers it all, and I will have she covers it all, and I will have a link to her website on the LA Talk Radio and the iTunes description of the show. So I hope you'll come back, because this has been amazing. Thank you so much for all your expertise and for kind of busting the myths and in such a way that makes it really, pardon the expression, digestible to all of us. So thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And that is our show for today. This is Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio. If you like the show, please leave a rating and a review, because the more reviews we get, the more ratings we get, the more people we can reach and help. Thanks so much. I'll see you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.